We'll listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers. Remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.
My baby does a hanky panky. My baby does a hanky panky.
The music of today's guest is played continuously, every day, in every country of the world. His songs are so ingrained in modern culture, it's difficult to go for more than a day or so without hearing one of them on the radio, TV, or a film soundtrack. My guest's records have sold over 100 million copies. He's been awarded 23 gold singles, 9 gold and platinum albums. And I want to say to my guest that if that sounds familiar, it should, because this is right from your website. Is that true, Tommy Jane?
It is true, every word. How are you?
I am fine. I've read your book a couple of times. What a book.
Thank you so much. I'm glad you like it. I really am.
The book is called Me, the Mob, and the Music. It could also be called the 3M book, MMM. And the subtitle is One Hell of a Ride with Tommy James and the Shondells. It's not all a feel-good, happy, jolly, peachy-keen, terrific ride. There are a lot of speed bumps. There's a lot of highs. There's a lot of lows. But I have to tell you, Tommy, this is one of the most honest books that I have
ever
read.
Well, thank you. I thank you for saying that. You know, it's funny because I've never been an author before, so this is very new to me. Also, you know, you never really know if you have gotten your point across until somebody tells you. I tried to be as accurate as I could possibly be, but you never really know if you conveyed the feelings that you were feeling until somebody tells you. So I appreciate that very much. I sure do.
When did you decide to write this book?
Well, my co-author, Martin Fitzpatrick, and I actually started this book about 8 years ago, and we were going to do a music book, basically talking about the hits and talking about the studios and so forth, and we were going to call it Crimson and Clover. And we got about a third of the way into the book, and we realized that we were only telling half the story. The other half of the story is Roulette Records, the label that we were with, and the people that were running Roulette Records. Most of the fans didn't realize this. Some of the people in the industry did. And, of course, I didn't either, and neither did the band when we first signed with Roulette. But Roulette was, in addition to being a functioning record company, also was a front for the Genovese crime family in New York. And the essence of the book is us trying to have a career in pop music. At the same time, this very dark and sinister and dangerous story was going on behind us. And, you know, Roulette was used as everything from a social club where these guys would hang out to, you know, illegal bank accounts where money was being laundered and so forth. And this was all going on at the same time. You know, we're doing Money Money and Crimson and Clover and Crystal Blue Persuasion. So it was really a very schizophrenic story.
I'll bet it was. And actually, the fourth M, we mentioned Me, the Mob, and the Music, of course, the fourth M is Morris.
Yes.
As in Mr. Levy.
Yes. The head of Roulette Records was a very notorious individual by the name of Morris Levy, who was quite literally a gangster. But he also had a good set of ears, and he really could pick hits, and he had an affinity for show business like very few people I ever met. He started the famous jazz club Birdland. He managed Alan Freed for years and brought him to New York, actually, from Cleveland in the very beginning of rock and roll. He came within a hair's breadth of trademarking the phrase rock and roll. Can you imagine?
If he had done that, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame probably would not be in Cleveland.
Be the Morris Levy Hall of Fame.
The Morris Levy Hall of Fame in New York City.
In Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, truthfully, he was a fascinating character, really, right out of the movies, but he also had this very dark side. And the people that he was running with were the people we had to deal with and were rubbing shoulders with at Roulette. Every day we spent up there, you know, anything could happen. We were dealing with radio stations, dealing with concerts and the fans, dealing with these characters up at Roulette. You know, I was very uncomfortable talking about this until the last of the roulette regulars passed on. I wanted to tell you that, you know, when we started out, we were going to do, you know, just a music book. And then we realized that we had to tell the roulette story, otherwise none of this would make sense. We sort of put it on a shelf for a couple of years. And then the last of the roulette regulars passed away in December of 05, and we felt that we could finish the story now.
You were born Thomas Jackson in Dayton, Ohio?
Right. That's right, 1947.
And you went to Niles, Michigan?
Right.
And, of course, this is covered in the book. Your first group was called the Tornadoes. Not to be confused with the Tornadoes who did Telstar. Different Tornadoes. You were kind of a vocal and instrument.
We were a very tiny version of that, yeah.
I can kind of make an analogy here, but your story with Hanky Panky is more dramatic, really, than Rock Around the Clock. Rock Around the Clock came out in 1954, and people kind of said, "Ah, that's a nice little record," and it didn't do too much. And it wasn't until a year later, when it was in Blackboard Jungle, of course, that it took off and became number one on the chart. Hanky Panky's story, there's kind of a little analogy there, because it also was a record that didn't take off at first except locally, but this story with Hanky Panky is much more dramatic. I mean, it was like a bolt out of the blue. All of a sudden, when you were not looking for a big opportunity, it happened.
That's true.
Now, you recorded in 64, I believe.
That's right. I was in high school when I recorded Hanky Panky as a favor to a DJ who was starting a little label called Snap Records in the Midwest. And he was actually the afternoon DJ on WNIL in Niles, Michigan, my hometown. And I had a job in the local record shop after school where I could promote my band and sell records and everything. And he walked in one day to buy records and said, "Listen, you still have your band, right?" I said, "Sure do." He says, "Would you like to record for me?" And I said, "Yeah." So we recorded four sides, and one of them was Hanky Panky. And the record was released when I was a junior in high school and went number one in about four square blocks and then died. So we kind of forgot about the record. I graduated from high school in 65 and then took my band on the road that summer. We got an agent in Chicago and went up through Rush Street and up through the Midwest. And I was working a club in Janesville, Wisconsin in early 66. And right in the middle of our 2 weeks, the club goes belly up. The IRS shut him down. And I was very dejected and depressed, and we sort of slumped back home to Niles. But that's how the good Lord works, because at that moment, Hanky Panky, this fluky little record, was exploding in Pittsburgh. I had no clue.
Wow. Now, but that came about because of somebody bootlegging the record.
Yeah, they bootlegged the record. They played it at dances and sold 80,000 of them in 10 days in the city of Pittsburgh. And we were sitting at number one. And I never even knew it.
Wow.
So they tracked us down because on the label it said Snap Records, Niles, Michigan. And if I hadn't have been home at that moment, if that club hadn't gone broke in the middle of my 2 weeks, there would never have been a hit record, there wouldn't be a Tommy James, and you and I wouldn't be talking here. They tracked me down. I went to Pittsburgh. I couldn't put the original band back together. So I went there and did shows on my own and grabbed the first bar band I could find, and they were called the Rack-On Tours. They were a great local act. They became the Shondells.
This sounds like
you were only in America.
And, of course, you got to Roulette Records, and you've discussed that in the book, how that happened. But right now, we're going to let everybody hear the song that started it all for you. This is Tommy James and the Shondells, and the most unlikely number one hit of all. This is Hanky Panky.
My baby does the hanky panky. My baby does the hanky panky. Walking on down the line.
Yeah, you know I love her every time. A pretty little girl standing all alone. Baby, can I take you home?
baby dies a hanky panky.
Panky, written incidentally by Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich, and they were, of course, the Raindrops, basically, and I believe it was actually originally on a Raindrops album, or maybe the flip side of a single, because they recorded it before you did.
They did. They had released it in 1963 on the flip side of a song called That Boy John. That Boy John was about JFK, and when he was killed, the record was taken off the market before it really had a chance to go anywhere. So Hanky Panky was on the flip side of that, so it was really obscure. And I heard a band called The Spinners, not the R&B group from the 70s, but a group of local players, play it at a nightclub where I used to go on Sunday afternoon when I was 16 years old. And I heard them play it and saw the reaction of the locals to it. And, you know, you just knew that was a hit record. And so when we got the chance to make records ourselves on Snap Records, the first record we did was Hanky Panky because we knew it was going to be a hit.
When you ultimately signed with Roulette Records, one of the things that intrigued me in the book is you said you did it without lawyers. I mean, you didn't hire a lawyer to make sure everything was kind of kosher.
That was the understatement of the year. I'm not quite sure where to start. We had taken the record to all kinds of record companies and basically got a yes from everybody. Got a yes from Columbia, Epic, RCA.
Well, why not? The record was taken off.
Well, yeah. And you remember Lori Records?
Oh, absolutely.
The Kama Sutra. And so we were flipped out that we seemed to have the pick of the litter, and the last place the record was taken to was Roulette Records. And the next day, one by one, all the companies call up and say, listen, we got a pass. What do you mean you got a pass?
Something's going on here.
Yeah, I thought we had a deal. Finally, Jerry Wexler up at Atlantic leveled with us and told us that Morris Levy, the head of Roulette Records, had called all these record companies and scared them all away, basically, and said, this is my record. Back off.
Wow.
And they did. And so that's how we ended up on Roulette. So when we originally went with Roulette, you know, contracts were put in front of me immediately. And we describe in the book our first encounter with Roulette and Morris Levy. It was really kind of funny but scary at the same time.
No lawyers, huh?
No lawyers. And they just put contracts in front of us, and we ended up signing them. And what it boiled down to was that our publishing monies and everything was cross-collateralized with our record royalties. And since they didn't intend to pay us anyway, it really didn't matter. It didn't matter if you had a lawyer.
At that time, of course, you were no longer Thomas Jackson. You were Tommy James.
That's right.
Do you remember when you got the name Tommy James?
I sure do. It happened in about 20 seconds. The fellow who had been shopping the record for us, there were two of them, Bob Mack from Pittsburgh and a fellow by the name of Chuck Rubin in New York. Basically, when Roulette decided to take us on, they wanted to put my name out front. And so I wanted to keep my last initial to Jackson. I wanted it to be TJ. And so they said, well, so what do you want? Jimmy Jones, Tony Jones, Tommy. What do you want for your name up front? And I go, James. So he says, okay, so it's Tommy James, right?
Yeah.
I said, yeah, I guess so. And that was it, boy.
That was it. But years later, when Ed Sullivan was describing who was going to appear on the following week's show, he announced you as Tony Jones.
That's right. Well,
and then
true.
He even got your birthplace.
Our first Ed Sullivan show, he mangled our name. And he called out, next week right here, Tony Jones and the Spandells will be here.
And when you finally appeared, he mangled where you were actually from. He said you were from New York City.
That's true. Well, doing the Ed Sullivan show was pretty scary because, you know, your whole career was on the line. If you screwed it up, your career could be over real quick.
We're going to go to a few of the records now that defined your career. Say I Am originally was done by the Fireballs.
That's right.
So how did you pick up on it?
Bob Mack, who was the Pittsburgh connection, got the record going in Pittsburgh, was a booking agent, a club owner, and he owned a record store. And the record store was right behind his office in the middle of town. And he went back to the same record bin where he found Hanky Panky and pulled Say I Am out of it and brought it to New York. We immediately had to record our second single, and so Say I Am became our second gold record.
You're looking for a loving man, a loving man, they say I am. You're looking for a hugging man, a hugging man, they say I am. If you're looking for a kissing man, a kissing man, they say I am.
When I first heard It's Only Love, I was intrigued by it. Just keeps the beat of that. It's just so good. Bump, 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 bump. Very catchy record.
By our third record, I had met Richie Cordell, who became our primary producer.
Right.
It's Only Love was written by Richie Cordell and his partner, Sal Tramacci. What happened was I was very fortunate when I got through Roulette because I was given the run of the place. And even though getting royalties was like taking a bone from a dog, they really did need us on a creative level. And so I was allowed to go out and find my own producers. And what I did was I was very intrigued by Kama Sutra. Kama Sutra Records was very artist-oriented. The Love and Spoonful were recording for Kama Sutra. And they seemed to have a lot of new writers and producers and were really state-of-the-art when it came to creative stuff. So I went over and kind of raided the refrigerator and brought over Sal Tramacci, Richie Cordell, and Bo Gentry. Bo and Richie ended up being my producers. It's Only Love was the first record by Richie Cordell and Sal Tramacci that they wrote, and I loved it. and we had another top 20 record with It's Only Love, and then they come to me with I Think We're Alone Now.
Well, we're going to get to It's Only Love first, and
sure.
Of course, as you realize, this is Roulette 4710. You all knew that.
4710 sounds very catchy.
Yeah, 4710, It's Only Love.
You can't laugh, you can't cry. You're acting kind of funny and you don't know why. Cause your heart like a big bass drum, and the beat's getting stronger and it's so much fun. And you keep on singing but the words are wrong, and you can't stop laughing, baby, what's going on?
That I Think We're Alone Now kind of brought your career to another plateau.
Yes, that's true. Until that time, we'd pretty much been a garage band. And
right.
I Think We're Alone Now, at a lot of different levels, changed the way we did business. First of all, Bo and Richie brought it to me as a ballad, believe it or not.
A ballad?
And they played it slow.
Wow.
You could hear that it needed to be sped up, but you could also hear that it was a smash.
Did it have the same lyrics when it was a ballad?
Yes.
Children Behave?
Yes.
I mean, that.
And when I say ballad, I don't necessarily mean a real slow song, but it was much slower than the record that we all know.
Children Behave. That's what they say when we're together. And watch how you play. They don't understand, and so we're running just as fast as we can. Holding on to one another's hand, trying to get.
I think we're alone now, Tommy James and the Shondells. Little did you know at the time that years later, Tiffany.
87. You know, the amazing thing with I Think We're Alone Now is not only did we have the new producers, but we also changed studios for that one. We went from Bell Sound Studios over to Allegro.
Right.
And the reason that was important was because Allegro was where we basically did almost all the rest of our records. We also acquired Jimmy Wisner, who became our arranger.
The Wiz.
Yeah, the Wiz. And he was very important because what Jimmy would do, he was sort of our George Martin. He would put these really lush orchestrations to essentially these nursery rhymes that Bo Gentry would write. And it was really an interesting combination. We began recording with the I Think We're Alone Now album, and we just changed directions. We became much more of a studio group. I began learning my craft as writer and producer. So I think the Think We're Alone Now project really became sort of the bullseye for a whole lot more of our singles.
The interesting thing is that I Think We're Alone Now became the backwards bullseye for the next one, which was Mirage.
Right.
This was a weird situation where a tape was inadvertently played backwards. And you decided
that's true. Back in those days, we would get tapes out of the studio. They'd generally be what was called a rough 7.5, and that was a 7.5 IPS reel-to-reel tape. And when you'd play that upside down, every now and then you'd accidentally get it on upside down, it would play backwards.
Oh, gosh.
So we got it on backwards one night. We were listening to the final mix of I Think We're Alone Now up in Bo's apartment, and we got it on backwards and listened to it and said, you know, that's not a bad chord progression. And so Bo and Richie took off with it and wrote it, and it became Mirage, which was our next single. So Mirage is quite literally I Think We're Alone Now backwards.
Gone now. I run to touch you, but you vanish through the doorway. And oh, how
hard it is to live without you. I love everything about you. Now I know you're really gone, but my imagination is so strong. I see you coming into view, and your face is telling me that you, oh yeah, oh, wanna be by my side.
Did you ever think of trying to reverse Hanky Panky?
Yeah, nothing ever worked after that. We tried it a couple times listening, but nothing ever sounded good after I Think We're Alone.
I'm Ronnie Allen talking with the amazing Tommy James, who has written an amazing book called Me, The Mob and the Music, One Hell of a Ride with Tommy James and the Jandels, soon to be a major motion picture and a major Broadway musical a la Jersey Boys. One thing that you mention in the book, and before we get to Moni Moni, and there's a story, but before we get to that, you aren't getting paid.
Well, that's true.
That's and a problem. I mean,
that was the issue with Roulette, and of course it became kind of dangerous when you made a fuss about it, because you weren't just dealing with Morris Levy, you were dealing with the people who were behind Morris.
Okay.
And that was where the rubber met the road, I guess you could say. That was the moment of truth. How were you going to deal with that? And so I had all these mixed feelings about, you know, did I really want to upset the apple cart while we're having this tremendous success at a creative level? Did I really want to, you know, kick the beehive and create some, you know, nasty other problems? And I always had to weigh those two things.
But you actually were getting money on the tours, so that
well, yeah,
was
it wasn't
surviving
like,
from that. Really.
That's right, the touring and the right. BMI monies and the radio airplay. Because we were having such success. But, you know, there were other acts who tried to go after their money. You know, Jimmy Rogers, for example, was left for dead on an L.A. freeway.
Did that have to do with...
You better believe it. You better believe it.
I interviewed Jimmy, and he didn't seem to know what caused anything.
Yeah, I know. Well, Morris Levy, I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but May Pang, who was John Lennon's lady for a long time, came to our book party when we released this book and told me the story of how Morris had threatened John. You know, John Lennon and Morris were in a huge lawsuit.
You mentioned how it was settled that John agreed to record, I think, three of his copyrights or something.
Yes.
For the rock and roll album.
When he reneged on that, Morris took him up the farm and threatened him. And this was, you know, this just shows how little respect Morris had for anybody when you boil it down.
We're going to talk about Moni Moni right now, and you basically had a song without a title.
Moni Moni was early 1968, and
right.
I always loved party rock. Party rock was always my, to me, it was just what it did to people on the dance floor. It just always made people move. There were certain records like Money by Barrett Strong and California Sun, and Mitch Ryder had put out party rock songs, glued them together, and they were, you know, this was just sort of a lost genre by 68.
Gary U.S. Bonds, too.
Gary U.S. Bonds, that's right. You know, the Louie Louies of the world. And so I just really had it in mind to put a party rock song together. I wanted to create one. So Moni Moni was kind of a tossed salad of every party rock record I ever heard, just kind of thrown into one. So we had done this track. You know, we had basically all the words to the song. Richie Cordell and I wrote it. But we still had no title the night before I was supposed to go in and do the vocal. And we knew that we wanted to put a two-syllable girl's name together. And we're looking, you know, for a Sloopy or a Boney Maroney or something crazy like that. And so we're really disgusted. And we throw our guitars down. We were up at my apartment in New York. And we throw down the guitars, and we go out in the terrace and light up a cigarette and look up into the night sky. And the first thing our eyes fall on is Mutual of New York Insurance Company, M-O-N-Y.
Wow.
With the dollar sign in the middle of the O, you know, and they gave you the time and the weather. And both Richie and I just started to laugh because we knew that was the perfect title, and it had been hanging there for years right in front of my face.
Stop it, call.
often said that we were so desperate that if we'd have been looking the other direction, we would have called it Howard Johnson's. Maybe Hotel Taft.
And that is another record of yours, Tommy, that eventually got remade by somebody else. In this particular case, was Billy Idol.
Yeah, we've had over 300 cover versions of our songs done by everyone from, you know, R.E.M. to, you know, Prince just had another number one record with Crimson and Clover this last year.
Wow.
And he released it as a single from his new digital album. And I'm just amazed how this music has stayed in front of the public. And I'm very flattered and honored by it. I truly am.
Well, when Money Money by Billy Idol was number one, wasn't it a back-to-back number one with the Tiffany record?
Yes, it was. They literally went up the charts like they were holding hands. Think We're Alone now went number one first, and it stayed number one for 2 weeks, and then Money Money goes number one for 2 weeks, back-to-back.
And if that wasn't enough, Joan Jett did a recording of the next record that we're going to discuss, which is Crimson and Clover, and her record made top 10. So, I mean, it was just kind of a wealth of riches for Tommy James recordings. Everybody wanted to do Tommy James material and Tommy James recordings. Crimson and Clover, wow. Now, that was an abrupt change of pace.
Well, you know something? I can't tell you how important that record was for us, because not only was it our biggest selling single, we did almost 6 million singles just right up front,
wow.
Of course. But what was really important is at that very moment, the record business changed from a singles market to an album market. And it happened literally overnight. We went out on the road, for example, at that very moment with Hubert Humphrey, who was running for president. This is late 1968. And we joined up with him in August of 68, right after the convention. And when we left town, it was all singles. So the acts were us, the Rascals, the Association, Gary Puckett. I'm leaving a bunch of people out, but I mean, you get the picture. And when we got back 90 days later, it was Led Zeppelin, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Joe Cocker, you know, all album acts. And Crimson and Clover was the one single that we worked on. I can't think of any other single we ever worked on that would have done this. Crimson and Clover allowed us to make that jump from AM Top 40 singles to FM Progressive Album Rock. And there's probably no other record we ever worked on that would have done that for us in one single. Crimson and Clover did that. It just so happened that right at that moment, we really got together and had some serious meetings on what we were going to do, because there was this mass extinction of singles acts right there. And everything was moving to FM radio. And we had a big decision to make. And we realized that we were going to have to burn our bridges with Bo and Richie and begin producing ourselves. The industry itself went from 4 tracks to 24 tracks in about 6 months. And we suddenly had to do all of our own writing, our own producing, our own recording, and had to do it all ourselves, even design our own albums pretty much. And Roulette allowed us to do that. I was very grateful, by the way, that Roulette allowed us the run of the place like that. Roulette started selling albums at that point, and we started selling albums with the Crimson and Clover album. So not many 60s acts were allowed to do that, you know, were allowed to make that transition, and we were very fortunate that we could do that at that moment.
What was Morris's reaction when he heard Crimson and Clover, which was so
different?
He loved it.
He really loved it. What he loved the most was that we were going to be able to go into the, you know, 69 and the 70s and be able to go into the 1970s selling albums. He loved that the most, because, of course, that meant more paydays for Roulette. By the way, Hubert Humphrey wrote the liner notes for the Crimson and Clover album.
Wow.
That was the first time a political candidate and a rock act ever really teamed up like that. So it was really an amazing moment.
Here is the biggest Tommy James record ever. This is Crimson and Clover.
Show her.
Season in Clover, and that's Tommy James and the Shondells. There's a record that actually came two releases after Crimson and Clover, but a lot of people associate it with Crimson and Clover because of the same kind of a sound in a way. We're talking about Crystal Blue Persuasion, but
sure.
Between those two records, you had a single called Sweet Cherry Wine.
Well, Sweet Cherry Wine actually was from another album. The Crimson and Clover album was a milestone for us. So many singles came from that album, but Sweet Cherry Wine actually came from the following album, Cellophane Symphony, but we had the single right then, and we really felt Crystal Blue was going to be another smash. We all loved that record, so to squeeze another hit out of it, we put Sweet Cherry Wine in the middle, and it turned out to be another number one record. Recorded Crystal Blue Persuasion before we recorded Sweet Cherry Wine. Crystal Blue, by the way, I want to say, was probably the hardest record we ever recorded musically, and the reason for that was we had completely overproduced it. We went in the studio and we had a full set of drums on it, we had guitars and several different keyboards, and when we were finished, it was just way too cluttered up. And we realized, you know, when we got done that we had just really overdone it.
Wow.
And so we began unproducing the record and started pulling things out. When we were done, the only thing that was left was a bongo and a conga drum, a flamenco guitar and a bass, and one little electric guitar to play the riff, and that was pretty much the record. I think we had a trickling Hammond organ over it also. But we really pulled out about 80% of the instruments we had on there. Crystal Blue Persuasion always reminds me of that magic summer of 1969.
What do you see? The sun is rising, most definitely. A new day is coming. Ooh, ooh. People
Recall in the book you said that somebody gave you the title Crystal Blue Persuasion.
A college kid down in Atlanta, but it came from the Bible. It came from the Book of Revelations, all the imagery from Crystal Blue. And actually, there was no political correctness back then. We didn't even know what that meant. So what basically was going on was I was becoming a Christian, and that's what Crystal Blue Persuasion was written about. Honestly, so many people have come to me and asked me if that was about drugs. And I said, no, man, it was just the opposite. So I'm glad to get that straight.
The Shondells did split up at some point.
1970, we had just recorded the Traveling album.
You became Tommy James, the solo artist, in 1970. Kind of a difficult thing in a way, a certain amount of adjustment.
The Shondells and I, after the Traveling album, really didn't intend to break up. We just needed a rest, and so we took 6 months off. That was the plan. And in the meantime, you know, everybody was kind of getting restless. Eddie and Ronnie started a studio in Pittsburgh, became very successful. Mike started a group called Hog Heaven, and I started producing other people from the Crimson and Clover album. The group The Click took Sugar on Sunday and had a top five record with it. I began producing Patty Austin over at Columbia, Benny Mardonis, Alive and Kicking with Tighter Tighter.
Was that a studio group or was it a real group?
Alive and Kicking was a group that was managed by my wife's best friend.
Your wife at the time was?
Ronnie. Her best friend was Doris Toter, and Doris was the manager of Alive and Kicking and had asked me to produce them. And I just never really had time to do it. We were in the middle of so many other things. And so I wrote Tighter and Tighter with Bob King, my songwriting partner at that time, for me. And we had done a track, and I went in the studio. I just didn't like the way it was coming out. I didn't like the way I was doing it. And so I said, you know what? This would be a great record for Alive and Kicking. They had a guy and a chick lead singer, so I quickly rewrote it as a duet and brought Alive and Kicking into the studio, and they did a beautiful job on it. And their guitar player took that great solo on it, and it was our track with me singing background on it and Alive and Kicking singing lead. So that became Tighter Tighter, and I took it back to Roulette, and we released it, and it went number one.
was Tighter Tighter alive and kicking. Did that group stay together? Did they go on the road?
Yeah, they're still playing today.
Really? So there is an alive and kicking group ever since that time?
That's right.
Wow. They're still alive and kicking.
They sure are. That's right. Well said. Gradually, I just got restless to go back in the studio, and I had recorded Ball and Chain and a couple of others that charted in the top 20s for us. And then in 1971, Bob King, my writing partner, and I, we had released a song called Dragging the Line on the flip side of Church Street Soul Revival. I had recorded with the group Exile.
Is that the Exile that did Kiss You All Over?
Yes. And they were signed with Columbia at the time, and we did a song with them called Church Street Soul Revival. And I liked it so much, I ended up recording it myself. And we threw Dragging the Line on the flip side of my version of Church Street Soul Revival. Well, all of a sudden we started getting severe split airplay on this, and Dragging the Line actually started getting played more. So we realized that we had given away a hit, basically, as a B-side, so we quickly pulled that back, and I put horns on Dragging the Line, and we remixed it and tweaked it and put it out as a single in 1971, and it just exploded.
In the book. Yeah,
yes, indeed.
Is.
And this was very serious because another family, the Gambino family, were taking over New York City, and of course Morris was on the wrong side. So right in the middle of Dragging the Line, all of a sudden Morris leaves the country with Nate McCalla, who had Cala Records up there, was distributed by Roulette. They leave for Spain and leave all of us up there holding the bag. My attorney calls me into his office and says, if they can't get Morris, they're liable to come after you because you're the only thing making money for Morris.
Oh, boy.
And we suggest that you leave town for a few months till this thing blows over. So that's what I had to do.
You went to Nashville?
I went to Nashville and recorded my Nashville album with Elvis's guys, DJ Fontana and Scotty Moore and Pete Drake and a lot of other great Nashville players. So the point was that right in the middle of Dragging the Line...
You had a high.
Yeah, I was just astounded that I had to do this. Just really...
I can imagine.
So anyway, that kind of was the beginning of the end for me at Roulette. I needed to get off the label. And Morris and I had some very dramatic confrontations that got pretty scary.
Which are related in the book. Me, the Mob, and the Music, One Hell of a Ride with Tommy James and the Shondells.
Wasn't all straight line. A lot of zigs and zags.
It was a lot of zigs and zags, but somehow you managed to stay alive. You managed to keep reinventing yourself. You kept reinventing your music. Who would have thought that Hanky Panky, you know, a novelty record, kind of a throwaway record,
yeah,
an accidental number one hit. It's like a fictitious story. If somebody wrote this as a work...
No, you wouldn't believe it.
You wouldn't believe it.
No, it sounds too unbelievable. I know. Well, I just, truthfully, I thank the good Lord and the fans for the kind of longevity I've had. This is a business that maybe gives you 2 or 3 years, and we've been doing it for 44 years, so I'm very thankful. I truly am.
Tommy, I cannot thank you enough. This has been a joy for me, and hopefully it will be to all of your fans who are going to hear this. Do you have any message to those fans who are listening?
I just want to thank the fans, of course, and I want to thank you. This is really what it's all about for me. This is my life, and the book which chronicles all this stuff is a very important thing for me because it lays it all out there as best as I can. I tried to be fair. I tried to be honest, and there was a whole lot of information to cram into 250 pages.
Yes, yeah.
I sincerely want to thank the fans for this amazing ride, and I mean that with all my heart.
It's still continuing. You're still performing?
We're all over. If somebody would like to come to our website, it's just TommyJames.com, and you can see where we're playing, and please come and see us. There's new stuff going on all the time. The next couple of years are going to be interesting
with the
movie and the play. And by the way, I have the original Shondells back in the studio. I told you, doing some music for the movie. We're going to be releasing a few more singles, actually.
The original Shondells. You're talking about the ones that actually...
From Pittsburgh.
The Raconteurs?
Yes, indeed, yes.
Okay. We're going to close the show right now with a hit record that you had that was not on Roulette.
That's right. This is from the early 80s, and this was called Three Times in Love, and number one AC, and top 10 on the pop charts, and I thank you for a great interview.
Covering a lot of ground, but everybody's three times.
Remembers the oldies, the 50s and 60s.